This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Isn't it equal?
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. II. Hey, Carrie.
How you doing, Stephen?
Yeah. So here's something that's on my mind as we get closer to the presidential nominating contests here in Michigan,
yep.
which will take place next week. On the Republican side, one of the candidates, Nikki mm-hmm. Haley, a former governor of South Carolina, former ambassador under Donald Trump, got into a little bit of a pickle when she was asked about the Civil War and its causes. She dodged the question, I think, but in doing so, tried to cast it as not being about slavery.
About states' rights.
About states' rights.
What they could and couldn't do.
And these other things that we sometimes hear people talk about that they say were the cause of the war or the purpose behind the war. And this was a while back, but it has stuck in my mind mm-hmm. since then. And it's also caused a really large discussion to unfold, especially on social media, about our history, how we handle that history, how we acknowledge that history, and how we move forward from that history. And so, you know, with her coming to town, essentially, to be on the ballot here in Michigan, mm-hmm. I thought it was something we should talk about, like, where does she get this idea?
Mm-hmm.
What's behind it? And why is it important
right.
to counter what she's saying with the truth? What's the reason to really be honest about things like the Civil War some 160 years after it happened?
Well, it's also important to note she has walked those comments back. A little bit. he knows that it was about slavery.
Yes.
That doesn't ignore the fact, or it doesn't negate the fact that she knew the information and chose not to say it.
Yes.
It was almost like she was holding herself back
yes.
from giving out that information. Almost strategically, it looked like.
It's a deliberate misdirection that is part of Republican strategy in some ways, right?
Yeah.
To appeal to voters who are uncomfortable with racial history, who are maybe not as enthusiastic about the cultural changes that, like, the civil rights movement affected. They have been appealing to those voters by really cynically playing into this kind of historical denial, which
right.
I just think is – it's not just factually incorrect. It can be dangerous.
Who do you have on deck this time to talk about?
One of my favorite people to have conversations like this with, mm-hmm. Eddie Glaude, who is an American academic and an author and a current affairs pundit. He is the James S. McDonald Distinguished University Professor of African American Histories at Princeton University. He's someone I've talked to a number of times, both on the radio and in person, and I follow him on social media. And he's been kind of in the center of this discussion
right.
about our history and racial reckoning and how we make all these kind of pieces fit together. You know, one of the great things about Professor Glaude is that he is really honest about how difficult this is. I think
yeah.
he acknowledges that there's a lot of people who are uncomfortable with these things and who feel named or accused mm-hmm. when you talk about the awful racial history in this country. And he has ideas about, well, how do you get around that to get to a space where we can talk about, okay, we got to fix those things and then go forward together.
Right. No, absolutely. This has broader implications too, beyond just the history of the Civil War, right? There's a lot of things right now that we're talking about that have to do with recognizing America's racial history and understanding kind of the policies and the protection we have in place nowadays so
yeah.
that we can in some ways account for it. And it's, you know, it's, there's no perfect fix for it, but, you know, with diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives,
yes.
with affirmative action.
Yeah. The conversation about reparations that's taking place in Detroit and every place else. All of these things kind of lean on that history
mm-hmm.
in some way. And so if you try to take that history out of the way, you know, undercut the whole thing, it becomes an argument about that rather than the things that we're trying to do
right
now. I mean, it really is a subversive way of confronting things like DEI or affirmative action.
It's so interesting because they're both very critical moments, but they're not together when we have those conversations all the time.
Right.
It's separately, we're going to negate the history. And then separately, we think that these policies are a threat to other, for the white people in this country. And if you really take a critical lens and put them together, it makes sense why we do the things we do nowadays.
Yes.
So it's really useful to look back and understand. Let's get into it.
Eddie Glaud, welcome to Created Equal.
All right, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, no, it's really great to have you here. So I'm going to start with this idea. I can't believe that in 2024, we're having a conversation about a presidential candidate who claims that the Civil War wasn't about slavery. I mean, it's almost incomprehensible that we are still having this argument in a country that was so plundered by the issue of slavery and the war that was fought to stop it. So I just want to start off getting us to clear the air a bit, talk about what the Civil War was about and how do we know what it was about?
Well, so first of all, it's such a delight to be in conversation with you. It is rather odd that here we are in 2024 still debating this question. But I think it's actually a testament to the success of lost cause ideology, that we're even raising the question of whether or not slavery was at the center of the Civil War. I mean, part of the kind of ideological battle that was fought since 1866 in Edward Pollard's book on the lost cause was to kind of recast the reasons for the South's defeat, to kind of render that region heroic, to foreground states' rights and the like. And so what we have, I mean, you know, the South lost the Civil War, but they did not lose the ongoing battle, the ideological battle around the historiography of that period, and particularly of the of Reconstruction that followed, and of course, all the things that happened since that horrific moment in U.S. history. So
in a way, you're saying that this is victory for us to even be talking about indulging this at this point is a victory of sorts.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, when Nikki Haley invoked that, you know, when she said what she said, I mean, it was straight out of the lost cause. And look, we were just grappling with just a few years ago, you know, Civil War, you know, Confederate monuments in the South, and those monuments were in part of the lost cause. And so that's in 2020, in 2019, in 2021. So you know, it's indicative of the ongoing battle we have faced in this country of grappling with, you know, the central contradiction at the heart of the enterprise. But I mean, you know, to get to the heart of your question, though, I mean, obviously slavery was central to the Civil War. It was, you know, think about the decade of the 1850s, from the Fugitive Slave Law or the Compromise of 1850 to the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854, the Dred Scott decision in 1857, John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. I mean, the election of 1860 with Abraham Lincoln. Slavery is at the center of all of this. So we just, you know, I think when we concede to the terms of the lost cause, we find ourselves responding to claims that are on their face absurd, and we need to understand that for what it is.
Yeah. So I also want to interject just a little of actual history into the conversation as well. And I think there's something particularly outrageous or even pernicious about Nikki Haley saying that there's a question about what was the issue at the center of the Civil War, because she's from South Carolina, because she was a governor there, and because that is the state that starts the Civil War, and they don't just start it by firing on Fort Sumter, before they do that, in fact, they say, we are leaving. We're leaving the Union. And they say why. In their articles of secession, they mention that there are immediate causes which have led them to decide to leave. And they say an increasing hostility on the part of the non-slaveholding states to the institution of slavery has led to a disregard of their obligations, and the laws of general government have ceased to affect the objects of the Constitution. In other words, slavery and the threat to slavery that the new president poses at that point in 1860, Abraham Lincoln, is the reason they leave. There is so little ambiguity about that, that Nikki Haley standing up to say that really – it's almost like, you know, she's laughing in our faces.
Oh, absolutely. It's she's gaslighting, right? And so in very clear ways. But, you know, I mean, what, Tom, John C. Calhoun threatened secession on several occasions.
Yes.
And I think it's really important for us to understand that this, the explicit defense of slavery and the ongoing argument over whether slavery would be allowed in territories and in those states that were or those territories that wanted to become states, right? We're at that question, of course, centered around who would have the power, who would dictate the future, the path, you know, the future of the country and the like. That all gets translated in interesting sorts of ways as an assault on the Southern way of life. You see. So states' rights becomes a kind of coded way of talking about the issue of slavery without talking about slavery, right, directly. So the idea is that you have, an overbearing, tyrannical federal government imposing its own moral will on the region of the South and challenging their way of life. And at the heart of their way of life, of course, is holding Black people in bondage. So it's reflective of the lies that we've told ourselves as a nation in order to absolve ourselves of the guilt of the horrors of slavery. And you know, the fact that Nikki Haley is from South Carolina makes it all the more egregious. But the whole lie is insidious.
Yeah, that guilt that you're talking about, I think, or you refer to there, is a very powerful part of this. And I find myself, when I'm listening to Nikki Haley or others who are trying to kind of wrap this awful history in cheery wrapping paper in some ways, there is this guilt. There is this sense that if you acknowledge that this happened, that this was a central part of the dispute that leads to the Civil War, if you acknowledge that this was a central part of the founding of this nation, there are many white Americans who fear that what comes next is an assessment of their character based on that. And it's this principal driver of this conversation, not just in a political context, but in a cultural one.
Absolutely. There's this kind of evasion of responsibility and accountability, you know? There's this sense that, you know, an acknowledgement of the horror of slavery and our responsibility for it would somehow call into question, you know, the very foundation of the American mythos, you know? And I think on a certain level, it's true. I mean, we have to confront the ugliness of who we are. I mean, one of the things I've said as I've traveled around the country and talked about this issue is that it's no different than, you know, in a Christian context, than admitting that one is a sinner.
Right.
And that admission becomes the kind of basis for one to be born again. You know, I mean, if you don't admit the fact that you are, you know, tainted with sin, right, in a Christian context, then there's no way that you can make your way back, right? You know,
yeah.
And so there's a sense in which our refusal to acknowledge the centrality of the peculiar institution to every facet of American life, right? Kind of, in some ways, locks us in, right? It we're permanently docked at the station because we refuse to admit what's at the heart of who we are so that we can become otherwise, it seems to me.
And do you feel like white Americans today should feel guilt? I mean, you know, you get to this question of, well, they did not do this, right? They didn't create the country. They did not make slavery a primary institution of the United States. I mean, this is hundreds of years ago now. Talk about how that guilt should be managed. What's the right way to think about it?
Well, you know, I'm not so much sure it's guilt. It might be a sense of shame. There's definitely an evasion of responsibility and accountability, right? There is this kind of ongoing view that, you know, racial inequality in the United States is the result of individual decisions.
Right, right.
That it's not a kind of reflection of, you know, the multiple generational nature of slavery and Jim Crow. That and once we concede, you know, that slavery and its legacy, its afterlife, impacted the quality of life of millions of darker American citizens, then one has to confront, well, what is the nation's responsibility to these folk, given that it was policy that produced the inequality that we're grappling with today? And so I think it's less a matter of guilt. It may be a matter of shame, although it seems to me that we've just lost shame completely in our political discourse these days.
Right.
But it certainly seems to me that it is an evasion of responsibility.
And a fear of that responsibility,
absolutely,
right? What does that mean? What does that say about me? What might be asked of me if I accept that there is some responsibility?
Right. I was rereading an essay by George Orwell, looking back at the Spanish Civil War, just yesterday. And what was so fascinating about rereading the essay is Orwell has this kind of deeply realistic and some almost borderline pessimistic view of human doings and sufferings. But he ends with this basic claim that, you know, we live in a world where people who have things don't want to give it up.
Right. A pretty basic precept,
yeah, and then
right?
Folks who don't have want to just want to have a decent life. And so you got folks who hoard, who don't want to give up what they're hoarding, and you got folk who have a decent life, who long for a decent life, just wanting to be able to put a roof over their heads. And so what we have in this country is that the fear of responsibility has something to do with, we're going to have to give something up, you know, and that fear of having to lose something, right, drives, I think, the panic around racial justice in this country. And in some ways, the panic around confronting our history, honestly, it seems to me.
Yeah. When we think about how we, I guess, turn that corner with Nikki Haley or the other political figures or cultural figures who are kind of leading people to this non-responsibility kind of space. I mean, what is it that is the lever we pull? I mean, I guess for me, the frustration is that this is so powerful, and especially in the age of social media. I mean, I spent a lot of time on social media platforms just watching how a statement like Nikki Haley's grows and spreads, and how it creates these conversations that indulge. What's the answer to that? I mean, it seems impossible.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard. I wish I knew. You know, sometimes, you know, I mean, it seems the straightforward answer is to just simply to counter it with the truth. But that's not enough. That's not sufficient, because the lost cause wasn't about what was really the case, right? It's not about the truth of the matter. It's about an interpretation aimed at distorting our perception, our way of seeing. our way of understanding the world. And so I think we have to begin to ask some very hard moral, ethical, and political questions in the face of these gaslighting moments, right? These moments where folk are appealing to grievance and hatred in these not so coded ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I think it's important to just simply tell the truth. This is just lost cause ideology. You know, what are you doing? You're being a Confederate right now. What's that all about? Right. And put it back on Nikki Haley in that instance, as opposed to just simply saying, you know, that's not true. You know, it's like the debate with CRT or critical race theory and DEI. You know, they don't care if they get it right. And we're constantly saying that's not what that means. And that's not the point. So we have to begin to argue at the level of motivation. What's motivating Nikki Haley to invoke this lost cause mm-hmm. ideology in this moment? And be honest about it. And in this moment, Doc, folk don't want to be honest with what's motivating Trumpism. What's motivating all of this stuff? They don't want to admit that the people that they love have bought into the ugliness of American racism in this moment. They don't want to admit it.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. You're listening to Created Equal on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and our guest today is Eddie Gloud. He is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. We're talking about history and race and the Civil War and slavery and the confusion that is essentially being injected by some conservatives and some Republicans about that history. Eddie, I want to start this part of the conversation in modern times as opposed to in history. And I want to read from a 2007 Supreme Court decision in a case that was about the use of race in assigning children to schools in Seattle. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in that case that the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who opposed the court's decision in that case, said the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to speak openly and candidly on the subject of race and to apply the Constitution with eyes open to the unfortunate effects of centuries of racial discrimination. I think that those two opposing quotes really crystallize how what we are just talking about the Civil War and its causes, still kind of plays out today in the ways in which we try to address inequality on the basis of race, that you do have one side that's saying, listen, policies that are race conscious are analogous to racial discrimination. Another side saying, well, you can't fix the problem if you're not conscious of the problem. It is such a crystal clear difference. And I think it really summarizes the challenge that we have.
Absolutely. And it goes all the way back to the antebellum period. I mean, you could see these arguments in the colored American in the 1800s, right? I mean, it's William Whipper and the like, right? Talking about racial designation. I mean, how does one talk about, you know, disparate policing based upon race without the category of race?
Right.
How does one talk about, you know, wealth disparities in the housing, or how do we talk about discrimination in the housing market without race language? How do we, you know, so in other words, we need the language to be able to describe the way certain groups are being singled out for differential treatment. And so in some ways, it's a bad faith gesture or a bad faith argument in the sense, right? So if we cannot use race language to describe discriminatory acts for fear that in doing so, we reinscribe racist thinking mm-hmm. right? That allows for that discrimination to exist unremarked, unnoted. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's one of the ways in which, you know, conservatives have, you know, distorted and twisted the notion of colorblindness for their own ends in order to maintain, you know, historical inequality. I mean, how can I put it? Racial inequality, Doc, is not an accident in the country. It is a result of deliberate policy.
Right.
And if we're going to undo it, we have to be as deliberate in trying to undo it as we were in creating it.
So let me play devil's advocate here just for a second. Is there something to the idea at all that we have become too obsessive about talking about race, and that it leans into the idea of it as a problem instead of as an opportunity to do something different? I mean, what Justice Roberts says there is, I don't know, there's something really, really plain and appealing about it, right? It's plain talk, right? Stop discriminating on race. Just stop talking about race. Talk about why if he's wrong, why we can solve this by leaning into our problems rather than thinking about our opportunities.
Well, you know, I think it's both and, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think we have to figure out ways to not fall into the trap of reducing human beings to race or to color. But we also have to be very, very clear and mindful of the ways in which race, right, organizes our social and economic and political lives. I mean, in those schools, I mean, when we think about how deeply segregated, right, American public education is, and how deeply rooted that segregation happens to be in terms of our tie to residential segregation and the history of residential segregation in the country, there's no way we're going to get to the place where race is like, you know, no different than the clothes I have on my back, right?
Right.
If we don't understand how it's impacting the distribution of benefit and burden, right? I mean, this is the thing. We live in a society where some people are valued more because of the color of their skin, and that valuation impacts the distribution of advantage and disadvantage. It has done so for generations. And we just can't blink and say that's not true.
Right.
And then move into some other way of being in the world. I think aspirationally, right? I would love to live in a society where the color of my skin isn't determinative of opportunity or burden, right? I would love to just simply be, to live fully in the culture that makes me who I am.
Right.
Without it coming with all of the stuff that it comes with in terms of a racist or white supremacist society. But we can't get there.
But you know that's not true. You don't live in that society.
Exactly. It's like Marx, you know, Marx is, you know, those who read their Marx know that, you know, he's not just going to jump to this classless, this utopian vision of a classless society. We have to go through it. So we got to figure out how to get out of history's ass pocket, as Baldwin would say. Right. You just can't just jump out of it.
Yeah. So I also wonder if it's worth. So sometimes I struggle with the idea that colorblindness is even the goal, right? And not in the utopian sense, right? Of course, we would love to have a world where color didn't mean the things that it does. But in a practical sense, I guess, the idea that you would be able to create a system of government or a structure of law that was colorblind just doesn't seem possible. And so, you know, I guess I wonder if the push for that is not so much an expression of optimism as it is kind of a cynical approach to saying, well, I know we couldn't get there to that, but I'm going to impose that because, you know, it in some ways it preserves the status quo. It preserves the idea of the inequality that we have.
Right, right. You know, I think for me, I keep, you know, what does it mean to be committed to the rule of law without exception? What might it mean to be committed to every child deserves, right, an education without exception? That everyone should have a roof over their head without exception. And when I keep saying without exception, because there's certain elements of the social contract in the United States that historically has come with exceptions.
Yeah.
That all of this applies, but not to Black folk.
But not to you. That's right.
All of this applies, but not to Native peoples, not to folk who aren't considered one of us, right? And this is where the rule of law runs into, you know, America as a nation of laws run into the notion of America as, right, being defined by blood, race, right, in some ways. And so I think instead of talking about colorblindness, right, I'm more interested in application of principles without exception.
Yeah.
A society that is just without exception. And once we get there, then we could bring the fullness of who we are. I'm not giving up. I love being Black. I am rich like the King of Kings because I was born in this tradition.
Right. I'm not walking away from that.
Nah,
right?
I don't want to give that up. I love being Black, but I don't want that to come with a set of, you know, assumptions about my capacities and my potential, a set of barriers and burdens because the society is organized in such a way that certain people are valued more and others are devalued because of the color of their skin.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
a different kind of orientation than some notion of colorblindness that's right. extracted from human doing and suffering.
I mean, I love that. I love that phrasing, right? Without exception. Can we create a set of standards that is applied without exception? And I'll be honest, I feel like at least on its face, that would appeal to most white Americans, right? I mean, or it should, it's analogous in some ways. It walks hand in hand with the idea of colorblindness without, you know, imposing this impossible to achieve, again, utopian standard, this idea that, look, all of these things that we believe we're going to apply equally to everyone.
Yeah, but then history haunts.
Right. We can't escape it.
Yeah, because we've built a society where we haven't done that.
Yeah.
And unless, you know.
And do you think most Americans don't want to do it that way?
Most Americans will say that they're committed to it, but they don't want to give up what they have.
Yeah.
In order to build a more just society. There's a zero.
And when
sum
you say
game,
give Don, up, and when you say give up, I mean, what are you talking about? What would they have to give up?
So let's
advantage,
just,
right?
Let's just locate it squarely within my area. So higher education. So, you know, we have a system in American higher education that's hierarchical. You know, you have all of these folks who want to get their kids into Ivy League schools. And so they're spending all of this money to open up these spaces, you know, and we want to question that at some point, right? Don't fall for the okey-doke and think that only a great education is at Princeton or Harvard or Yale, but that's a different argument. But so there are all of these spaces, and those spaces were, they used to be only for a particular population. And as those institutions have tried to build, classes that reflect the full diversity of American society, of American life, there aren't as many seats available for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And all hell has broken loose. So DEI, on a certain level, the kind of, you know, worry about DEI is about, you know, I can't get my kid that I've spent, you know, $60,000 a year at Lawrenceville Prep or Exeter into Yale.
Right.
Because they're allowing these black and brown and women and LGBT folk in, you know, all of these folk in. And so it's a zero-sum game. I have to lose something if we're going to be more equitable in our society, which presumes that, you know, the inequities before were more just.
Right.
You see, and that's just one example that we could talk about. And so
but let's roll with that example a little bit.
Sure.
And is that fair? Is that fair that the person who has the expectation that their child can get into Yale or Princeton or Harvard would have to give that up in order for there to be a more equitable system? And if that's true, how would you ever convince that person to go along?
Well, I think we have to convince folk that, you know, everybody's, you know, folks are going to land, you know, if you don't go to Yale, they're going to end up at Amherst or Williams or Swarthmore or Harvard or Princeton or University of North Carolina. I mean, we have to disrupt the hierarchy. That's, yeah. You know,
yeah.
I think fundamentally, but I think it's important to understand that there's no guarantee that, you know, because you have spent all of this money and that you will work on Wall Street, that your child should automatically have access to these institutions. And it's going to be hard to convince folk that I'm trying to say this in a way that doesn't buy into, you know, the illusion that these Ivy League schools are the best that they mm-hmm. could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that these schools should be committed to building classes that reflect the full diversity of American life. So my daddy couldn't go to Princeton.
Yeah, right.
He couldn't attend. Or it's like the NBA, you know, we couldn't play in it.
Right.
Then when the field was leveled, we were able to play. You know, so I'm just saying, like, you know, it's going to have an impact. And so we just got to be committed to the ideal and fight for it, understanding that people are going to be unsettled by it.
Yeah.
But they're going to land on their feet. They always do.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break.
That wasn't clear, though.
Right. We're going to take another quick break, and we're going to come back and have more of this conversation with Eddie Glaude of Princeton University. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. You're listening to Created Equal on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and our guest today is Eddie Glaude, who's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. One of my favorite things about you is how prolific you are on Twitter. I can always kind of follow what you're thinking about. But you asked on February 8th of this year, why do Democrats continue to engage Republicans as good faith actors? Which I think is a really provocative question. And I kind of want to broaden that a bit and talk about the Sure. idea of good faith and the role that you think it plays, not just in racial reckoning and has to play in racial reckoning, but the role that it plays in the systemic change overall that you see us in need of in this country. It seems to me that so much of the American compact rests on the idea of that good faith. And I get the sense that for you, you're not seeing it. You don't see it as intact.
Right. I you know, it's one thing for us to disagree about what freedom entails. It's one thing for us to disagree about what flourishing in the U.S. Mm-hmm. consists in, right? And what's the responsibility of government in helping us in our individual lives. We can have a disagreement on the role of government, but we could hold a joint commitment that every human being should, in the United States in particular, should not only be able to dream dreams, but to make their dreams a reality. How we go about arguing or thinking about how that happens, we could disagree, right? But there's some background conditions that allow us to have that disagreement, right? But I think that there are those who hold views who are engaging in public deliberation or public argument who aren't being honest about what motivates their positions. Right? They believe, many of these people, that America belongs to white people. And more importantly, belongs to rich white people. Right? And they're willing to exploit grievance and fear, right? In the name of a certain set, in the name of that vision. And then they present that, that's what's motivating their claims, but then they present it in a way that has us arguing about, right, the role of government, is overreach, right, you know, healthcare, you know, all this stuff. And it seems to me, if people aren't honest about what motivates their positions, it becomes very difficult to engage them, right? So, you know, if I hear states' rights, Steve, if I hear that argument, I'm going to immediately move to there. That's just a code for racism. But somebody might actually believe in it. But it's we got to be able to engage in the back and forth in order to see. But in this current moment, man, it's so much bad faith. That trust, which is at the heart of any deliberative democracy, can't be presumed.
And so where does that leave us, I think, is the question that always jumps into my mind. You know, I mean, there are a lot of people who say, this is broken. This is fundamentally broken and probably can't put it back together because of the things that you're pointing out, that this idea of acting in good faith is so broken. But that doesn't seem to me a very practical way to think about it. I mean, what does that mean? We're going to divide everything up and go our separate ways, or, you know, something worse than that. So in your mind, what does that ask us to do? What does the moment, I guess, call for if that's where we are?
You know, I think it calls for almost a kind of a moment where we give voice to a new social compact. Huh. Right? What are our obligations to each other? And what are some baseline things that we could all agree on, that if you're American, that this is where we all start? You know, everyone should have a decent roof over their heads. Everyone should be able to, you know, to put food on the table. Everyone shouldn't go broke because they're sick. Every child should have a decent education. What's our social compact? What are our social obligations to each other? And what's the role of government in ensuring that baseline, you know, level of existence? We have to have that argument, because what I think, where we are now is that some people believe that certain things belong to them, that a certain social contract is only relevant to them and to theirs, and all of us should just simply shut up and be grateful that we're here. So I think part of the way in which we rebuild trust is we have to state clearly, not in the name of some, you know, myth, some ideology of American innocence or you know, perfection, right? But rather, this is who we are. And then to build a way of life, a set of policies that actually make it a reality.
Yeah. It does.
Does that make sense?
It does. And just sitting and listening to you articulate that reminds me of, you know, the power that gave birth, and the thinking that gave birth to the civil rights movement, right? And its sort of apex in the late 50s and 1960s. But that was a pretty difficult time in our history. I mean, not the most difficult, but there was a lot of tragedy that unfolded as a result of African Americans taking that very position that you're talking about. There was a lot of struggle, and yes, we got an enormous amount of change, of structural change. But then here we are, almost, you know, 50 some years later, and we're still talking about the same stuff. And we're talking about it in an environment where it's very difficult to imagine that you could muster the same will and organization and sacrifice that people did back then.
Well, look, the last piece of what was the last major piece of legislation of the goods of the Great Society was
Fair Housing
Act of 1968. Yep. 12 years later, Reagan is elected to undo it. Just 12 years. So you think 15 years from the Voting Rights Act. So the social revolution of the mid-20th century, right, was immediately under assault as it was happening. And then Reaganism, right, emerged as an ideological counter to that. And right now we're relitigating everything. The Black Freedom Movement, the women's movement, the gay liberation movement, we're right squarely there. And so I think it's important for us to understand that Reaganism or neoliberalism or however we want to describe it is collapsing right in front of us. Trumpism is a caricatured version of it. But all of the contradictions of that economic philosophy, of that political philosophy, all of those contradictions are in full view. And the challenge for us is not to kind of long for the stability of early forms of Reaganism. Our task in this moment, it seems to me, Brother Stephen, is as this is collapsing, to imagine something different, to step into this critical juncture and to do the political work of imagining a different relationship to each other. And the challenge we face, I think, is that you have people who want a sense of normalcy by, you know, longing for the very thing that sought to undo what the mid-20th century revolution was all about.
The undoing of it is the thing that I think we've lived with for 50 years, right? The current moment where you have a presidential candidate, back to the beginning of our conversation, who says, even our history is not what we say it is.
You know, Baldwin said, you know, the price of the ticket is that these folk have to become white. And Ralph Ellison talked about this tricky magic in Shadow and Act. You know, he has this wonderful formulation where he says, when, you know, the country has yet to discover itself.
Yes.
And when the contradictions of its identity come into full view, right, it engages in the scapegoat. It engages in these horrific rituals in order to consolidate a notion of whiteness. And it's, he says, that's that tricky magic. And so we find ourselves in this moment where the alchemists are doing their thing. And we need to understand it for what it is and not concede, you know, not concede the ground.
Yeah. Okay, Eddie Glaude, it is always great to talk with you, and it was especially great to have you here to talk about this moment in American and African-American history. Thanks so much for joining us on Created Equal.
Man, thank you for having me. What a wonderful conversation.
Yeah.
You take care of yourself.
So really great conversation, as it always is, with Eddie Glaude. He has this optimism that comes through all the time.
The social contract element was the one for me where I was like, okay, all right. I still don't know if folks who are already neglecting the history would then agree to a social contract to say, let's all identify who we are.
Yeah.
Isn't that what the original documents were supposed to be there for?
It was. But I mean, I think the way that he tries to reframe things so that people are not feeling like it's an attack on them.
Right.
Right? That we're talking about opportunity for you too.
For you too, yeah.
Right? That's huge.
That's good.
And I think so much of our political narrative right now really fails on that score. He's really great at saying, there's a different way to think about this, right?
Yeah.
And if you think about it this way, you don't come out on the losing end. That'll do it for this episode of Created Equal. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobin. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.